Beyond Your Table, From the Real Dirt to Common Ground. It's a new podcast, and it's a podcast that myself, Roger Wasson, and Michael Dimmick are starting. Michael, explain, how are we going to get from the real dirt to common ground in this podcast?
Well, we're going to sit down with farmers meeting the challenges of our day. That is, environmental challenges, health challenges, climate challenges, social challenges with farm workers. I mean, some incredible things are happening, and we're going to be bringing people into conversation with farmers who are doing that stuff.
COVID hit, and with a sense of urgency that there would be extreme and episodic events, disruptions to our supply chain, and that the time was now to really reimagine and accelerate the future of agriculture. Farmers' sense of resolve to plant it forward no matter what has been inspiring. Despite, you know, going into the spring was probably the most hopeful of springs everybody had hoped for, because the last two harvest seasons were the worst in a generation. And then, you know, of course, we get COVID. You couldn't have imagined that. The supply chain did not break, but it certainly bent, and we learned a lot from it.
I'm Roger Wasson, and that was Aaron Fitzgerald, the CEO of the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. My co-host of Beyond Your Table, Michael Dimmick, interviewed Aaron last year, soon after she joined USFRA. Well, today, farmers and ranchers across the country are also struggling with the effects of the pandemic. Well, Michael and I talk with Aaron about dealing with these pressures and also the next 10 years facing American agriculture.
Aaron Fitzgerald, nice to see you again. Since last October, when we had our first conversation about your work at the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. That was a great, enjoyable discussion on a beautiful day at Asilomar. And so we're going to pick it up, have another conversation today, but we're joined by my colleague, Roger Wasson. And actually, Roger is the guy who introduced me to the U.S. Farmers Ranchers Alliance years ago when they were doing food dialogues. Right, Roger?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, at the time, there was some feeling that how can we show that we're reaching out to all segments of agriculture? And they were some people were reluctant to get involved in the early years of food dialogues. And so I was helping in those early food dialogues. And I kept trying to reach out and bring people involved that had a little different point of view for those people that would say, gee, you guys are only working with large-scale agriculture that's corn and soybeans in the Midwest. And Michael's clearly not that. Michael's never been bashful. And he's a friend, but he'll speak up. And so part of the job was, I said, well, look at Michael. Why don't you come on involved? And he did, and he came to some of the first food dialogues and got criticized from some people that thought, gee, this outfit is just trying to promote, you know, large-scale agriculture. And Michael, you could speak for yourself, but you got a little pushback on whether or not you had kind of sold out to the other team or something.
It was interesting, but I have no regrets at all. I believe in dialogue, and I believe there's a lot more in common ground than there is things that divide us. And that's why I was quite excited when you told me, you were the first one actually that mentioned that Aaron had joined U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. So Aaron, let's get caught up. It's been, the world has changed. We have COVID-19 now, and we're very curious. What has it been like? What are you hearing from your producers and members?
Well, thank you guys so much for having me on the call. And I really appreciate that legacy conversation about where we were, but most importantly, like where we are now. You know, I think we've, as you mentioned, COVID hit. I think, Michael, the last time I was on, I was talking about how we were activating a leadership network to really tackle and take on the next decade of agriculture like never before, that we needed to work together. And with a sense of urgency that there would be extreme and episodic events, disruptions to our supply chain, and that the time was now to really reimagine and accelerate the future of agriculture. Little did we know that 3 months ago, every leader would be tested to step up and step out together as a sector. And, you know, it's been a sector that I would say, in a way, just so humbled. You know, the farmer's sense of resolve to plant it forward no matter what has been inspiring. It gives me, you know, despite, you know, going into the spring was probably the most hopeful of springs everybody had hoped for, because the last two harvest seasons were the worst in a generation. And then, you know, of course, we get COVID. You couldn't have imagined that. And then to see as well, there was two types of what I would characterize as experiences. And even now, one is a sector that is really taking solace in their dinner plates, right? It wasn't so much quarantine as much as gourmetine, thousands of recipes and selfies and of your photos, of your food, sharing it with your friends and colleagues, really connecting back to your plate. And then for another segment, you know, I would say, and this isn't mutually exclusive, but, you know, there's incredible amount of exasperated food insecurity, as we saw so many Americans turn to Feeding America, and many really realizing the interdependency of the food system and having to shift so radically from what I would call restaurant to that whole distribution sector, really having to now move into individualized prepared meals and or boxed meals at Feeding America. And, you know, I would just say it's been a shift. The supply chain did not break, but it certainly bent, and we learned a lot from it.
Erin, could you explain some of that bending of the supply chain? The dairy producers, there's a lot of consumers have been noticing that they've seen that there have been milk that's had to be dumped. And then they also hear about hogs that aren't able to go to the processing plant, and some were at least considering euthanizing hogs because they weren't able to process them through a plant. That has to be really frustrating. But could you kind of explain what's happening there? Because it's, as many times as you hear the story, it's kind of hard to absorb.
Boy, it certainly is hard to absorb. And I think for our farmers, it's, you know, farmers are in the business of caring for animals. And, you know, people don't realize that the slaughterhouse actually is the one that is processing those animals. You know, I think people don't understand the physicality of the way a barn operates. They're like, well, can't you just put those cows, you know, or those animals, you know, out on pasture? And, you know, if you're in quarantine, you know that you have a living room with four people in it. And once you have if you had added four more babies, it becomes a more constrained space. And so the other thing is, in agriculture, we're timed for spring. This hit right at a very seasonal aspect when all this stuff is happening on the farm and babies are being born. And so, you know, a lot of our farmers changed the feed rations, tried to, you know, and are having to, in some cases, make difficult decisions. Thank goodness a lot of the pork processing plants and beef processing plants will be able to get back on the line. And so we're now seeing that kind of dissipate some of those decisions, but still really incredible pricing decisions that are having to be made. And that's just on the animal protein side. On the dairy side, what you saw is that there was not enough processing being able to clear the market. There's a couple great case studies where in Idaho, called Curds and Kindness Program, there was resourcing available, and they sent a note out to all the processing plants and cheese plants to look at. Normally competitors don't share information, right, with one another, mm-hmm. but they shared information and were able to find excess processing capacity and actually clear all the excess fluid milk and stopped dumping in Idaho because everyone started working together. So it's things like that that really make you go, okay, there potentially are some learnings here, right? Sharing pre-competitive information, working with your competitors, being prepared for this type of resiliency. But more importantly, I think we saw the interdependency like never before, and perhaps officially realized and sunk in, is that there is a hyper interdependency between our processors and our farmers that might have always seemed disconnected. But now I think everyone is, when you talk about sustainable supply chain, it is how are you a resilient sustainable supply chain, and you're really working together, because you're only as good as, you know, your processing, and your processors are only good as the farmers.
So the farm, I was just going to, one question about the dairy farmers, that if they are aimed at producing cheese and then you've lost the school lunch program when the schools weren't in session and so many of the restaurants were big cheese users, But I understand that a lot of that cheese now is getting redistributed in all these other kind of feeding systems. And so it's finding a home, even if it's not going through schools, and even if the restaurants aren't fully up again. So that was one of those switching in midstream, I think.
Yeah, so, you know, I think we can take a lot of lessons from other sectors. So if you look at, like, let's say Tesla or Ford and some of these manufacturing plants, they have agile manufacturing processes. They were really able to quickly adapt and be able to create masks and ventilators and the like. In the case of the food sector, we're dealing with hyper-specialized food safety requirements, often large bulk that is really intended for the restaurant supply chain. So in the case of cheese, you're talking about gallon drums, you know, of cheese. In the case of the egg, most of the eggs people aren't aware actually goes through fluid eggs, like the egg beaters that you see, and they're in large gallons. Well, now they need to get more into that individual egg beater type format, right? So with a lot of redistribution, the plants aren't really geared for that type of switch very quickly. They're hyper-specialized, largely due to food safety. And so that, I think, is a real opportunity in the future, is how do we think about more individualized and agile manufacturing techniques with food safety in mind.
So this is good, I because it gets us into something that I've been thinking about, which has to do with trust. You know, there when the workers in the plant started to get ill, there was all these negative articles about meat processing and big concentrated animal feeding operations. So the question more generally, though, is, do you think that COVID will negatively impact people's sense of trust around farmers? Because one of the things that I saw from the video that introduced me to you, really, that got me to call you, that great video you did about farmers embracing climate change, what I saw is great hope for more unity between farmers and the general public, more sense of that farmers are leading the way in dealing with this major challenge. Do you feel there's any potential setback because of what's happened with COVID?
No, I don't. You know, I think COVID got us to learn a bunch of things about every single sector. I think it surprised everyone. Interestingly, if you look at the Edelman Trust Barometers and a lot of the consumer trust, is that consumers actually, for the first time, actually wanted to know where their food came from. Where it used to be, I just kind of took it for granted that, you know, everything would be perfect in the grocery store. They kind of started getting into the details of the supply chain. So that, you know, you could say is a negative, but I actually think it's a huge positive because, you know, many of the consumers weren't really aware of what the farmer has to go through in this case. And also we have a hidden workforce. As you saw, those essential workers, like, really going in to work, you know, every plant manager wants their employees to be safe, right? I mean, nobody wants to see that kind of level of incident. And I think everybody went into mode to, like, go fix it. But I do think it gave us an opportunity to really look at the transparency of the supply chain. I think consumers were finally going, I had no idea it had all these different steps, you know. I think that's a tremendous opportunity, and and we need to do a better job of explaining it. And to that point, you know, the first question you asked, that means that there's some tough conversations, you know. I remember I had a conversation recently with my sister who doesn't know anything about the food, but she works in the medical community. And she was like, you know, how could you possibly be sending people into a food processing plant right now? And I said, well, my gosh, Katie, just like you sending people into the hospital, we don't sign a code of ethics, or I think the doctors sign, you know, all nurses and everyone, that they want to do what's right, do no harm for the patient. We also have an ethics to provide food for people. So, I mean, there's a level of commitment there, you know, that is within our food sector. But we need to do a better job of saying, like, yeah, we're doing this because we want to make certain that food is on your plate. We take this seriously. And, you know, food, processing food is a matter of national security. I think we did find that out too. You know, it was essential. We were on the front lines and we needed to respond.
You know, it is a controversial spot, obviously, because people are concerned that they may be forced to go back into packing plants too quickly. Is there a role for for farmers to be say, sure, we do need to get these processing plants going, but for crying out loud, make sure that there's all the protective equipment and all the other things, and that you're, you know, being extra careful and changing what you need to change so that there's less risk. Is there a role for the farmers to be speaking up about that as they take care? Yes, open the plants, but be extra careful that they're, it's safe for the workers.
I do think everybody was saying that. I think everybody, I mean, human health has been the biggest thing. I know the pork, the beef industry, everyone was really asking to make sure that they had the, you know, provisions of protective gear. That has been a front and center. I mean, that really comes down to that legacy of food safety and worker safety. You know, I mean, that it's essential. And I think you saw many of the processing plants get back online, but really slowing down. And that's what you're still seeing in the lag, because the spacing is improved. There's protective barrier glass. They have to go in and get, you know, temperature screened now. If you look back, I really don't think anyone was prepared for across any sector for a scenario plan of what would need to happen in a case like this. And, you know, I think we saw a really terrible month right in May. But things went into place very quickly. And I do think that's largely because we have seen instances in the past of animal health issues, such as H1N1. There were protocols in place that we have used with animals. We just did not imagine the human factor. And so I think we learned a lot and they moved quickly. But definitely, again, it comes back to that bent, but not broken.
I'm thinking about how well you articulated the need for the entire industry to embrace this idea of resilience and action in the face of climate change.
Yeah, so 2 months ago, you know, as I said, we didn't know that this leadership network would be tested, right? We've been saying extreme and episodic events are coming. This is not business as usual. We have to work together from farm to fork in a collaborative mindset. We have to have all stakeholders at the table, all ideas. And, 2 months ago, we put forth our leadership listening sessions. We'll be coming out with some of the learnings from those sessions. And then in September, we'll be really continuing to work on this common vision and common idea of what a decade for ag could look like. We were going to do that this year. Now, that's delayed. Are we still mission-driven to go get that done? Absolutely. But I do think there is a mindset shift that this, we cannot continue like this. We need to start really investing together across the supply chain. We need to have different, not only harmonized metrics and indicators, but we have to have new business models that are going to go address this. And we have to have a common set of values and principles that we're going to operate on. And so from that perspective, you know, you could have said we're going to be pulling people towards a common vision and commitment framework. But now it's almost like an Aikido move where everyone already knows that we have to change. And so to take that trajectory and move it towards that positive future, I think is really our window in the next 6 months.
So are you using that and applying it to, say, for example, the COVID situation? Then what improvements or safety standards or flexibility in processing options and things like that that would be on the table and saying, how can we be better prepared and how can we have a just improve the system that's what it's going through?
Yeah, I think for us that resiliency, and we'll still come back to climate change and soil health and farmer livelihood, I think rural vibrancy, labor vibrancy issues, I think are a key aspect. In particular, we launched a project called Transformative Investment for Climate Smart Agriculture, largely because, you know, if you look at the last 2 years, the financial economic situation is pretty dire. And we're seeing a flight of capital, actually, in the sector as a whole in food and ag. We had National Restaurant Association on the line, and combined with food and ag, we're the sector that has lost the most jobs. And if you look at the total economic impact to the whole sector, it's pretty stark. And so we have a real opportunity, I believe, as we think about sustainability, right? It's having the goals and the aspiration, but the key to sustainability is also making sure that economics is there, right? And we need to make sure we're investing in food and ag as a essential sector, as the backbone of American economy. And that is a big component, I think, of what we need to focus in on in the future. I mean, we're a pretty big workforce, if you think about it.
Well, so this, you know, with what you just said, and based on the question that Roger asked, one of the things that came out, at least, I don't know if it was in the Midwest, you were getting the same kind of news stories, but certainly on the coast, you were hearing a lot about the fact that this moment has showed the strength of the small and medium-sized farms that had more direct relationships with their consumers. They could more quickly move to what you said at the beginning, where they were direct marketing through CSAs and other forms. And do you think that this event will, in a sense, create a little bit more equality in terms of voice and focus about the future of agriculture between the large and the small, because we see how they fit together and they have different roles and provide more resilience by both existing simultaneously?
Yeah, I don't always think about size of farm so much as type of farm or markets for farms. I guess I believe every farmer, every acre, like they all are doing what's relevant for their business. But I do think what you're going to see is a lot more in terms of direct from the consumer. So we were already seeing box meals go up. We were already seeing hyper customized meals. And I think you're going to continue to see this new distribution model, if you will, for food only emerge and continue to emerge. Mm-hmm. And so the connection to that and farming, I think, remains to be seen.
Okay. Yeah. I guess, but if you look at how, let's say, U.S. government policy works, I know you don't focus on policy, but the programs that are now designed benefit mostly the larger institutions. They're set up for that. It's my sense is that maybe there's some opportunities to more equitably support all scales of farming with policy and programs in the country.
Yeah, I think like as any supply chain is looking at, you want to make certain you have diversity. So you think about resiliency, right? Then you do scenario planning. And so that would include, I think, diversity of the supply chain. And so I do think that you're going to see from, you know, I don't do policy, but from operations and investment perspective, I do think that you're going to see many of these supply chains really think through the diversity of their supply.
You know, Aaron, when I have conversations with you and when we have conversations about agriculture, I'm so humbled. You know, I've been in agriculture my entire life, and yet the more I see of agriculture, the more diverse it is, because when you think of trying to represent all the farmers in the country and everybody that's raising food as you are, it's a huge, huge challenge. And I'm just wondering, as you've jumped into this job with USFRA, are you seeing changes taking place in how people are viewing farmers? Are they viewing farmers, farmers market farmers differently than larger scale farmers? I know at the very beginning of the food dialogues, when we established those, there was a concern that there was some negative perceptions, and there was the potential of people misunderstanding. How do you view the progress that's been made today, and how is that challenge different today than it might have been when the U.S. farmers and ranchers were getting started?
You know, I think, you know, when U.S. farmers and ranchers were started, it was tell my story. You always hear like farmers say, I'm the 1% of people who farm today, and there's these other 99% who just don't get us.
Yeah.
And I always say, well, who's the other, you know? And then I also think about like, well, who cares about the topic and is willing to learn? Because, you know, farming is really complicated. Like it's this art and the science, and you got this weather thing, and then you got this climate thing, and carbon and nitrogen. You can just name all the words and people's eyes start glazing over, right? Yeah. It's complicated. And so I feel like what we've changed in the last 10 years is that there, particularly the younger generation, actually cares just flat out about where their food comes from. 87% of consumers consider lifestyle, health, and sustainability or fit somewhere in that world. in their purchasing and decision making. That has definitely changed. I do also think that farmers now are a little bit more approachable to being talking about this stuff. There's a new generation of farmers that are willing to like engage in it, where, you know, there's also a culture related to farming too, where it tend to be a little bit more introverted. Why are you asking me these questions, you know? And how could the consumer just not get me, you know? And again, because it's complicated, it's about this biological process and all stuff, they don't necessarily get it. So we have along that last 10 years, the consumer has evolved with the farmer, I think. And we're in a new place. And it's beyond just telling the story about, it's more about what do we need to go do? And we've got to meet the business models where they are. And this has not been, this is not business as usual. And we need to create a sustainable business model for the future. And if, in order to do that, we've got to work all across the supply chain, because I think even with COVID, you find out there's a lot of stakeholders who move one product just to get it to the consumer. And if we're not all working together, you know, we're not in it to win it, so to speak.
That reminds me of the idea of value change. I remember early on in my work, we were thinking a lot about how to support the mid-scale farmers who have the hardest time in the system. The small niche guys can do it, and the big guys can do it because they have scale. It's those middle farmers who have often the big challenges. And I remember I was part of a project based in the Midwest where people were trying to build value change, where the values around farming, rural communities, the environment, quality food, trust were part of the story, the marketing story for these mid-scale producers. And what you just described, the need, the big key was to get all those pieces in the chain working together, sharing the same message. And what I'm hearing you saying is that is becoming kind of the mainstream idea now. Everybody has to do that, no matter your scale. You have to be doing that. Is that right? Did I hear you correctly?
Yeah, I definitely think it's right. And then I'm just thinking as well, for the small, medium, and larger producer, we've also seen a resurgence in the cooperative business model, right, in the last decade. And I think that that's really helped as we look at these co-ops really working on those value-added services, not just in the communication aspect, but in really being able to provide all these unique services that many of our farmers are really being faced with now.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Michael, do you remember when we had the first conversation about the video, which is what, is it 30 seasons?
30 harvests. We have 30 harvests to get it right.
30 harvests. But I don't know if you remember, Michael, but we were comparing notes and saying, this is kind of a bold step. We were both surprised in a way that you took that step and you were out there and you were sharing something, I think, different than what we had seen before. And I think it was very well done. And I assume you got good feedback. Did you get any negative feedback?
You know, I would say the negative feedback that we got was maybe from our own farming group. We're like, oh, if he was really going through this tough of a time, he wouldn't have been driving that truck. You know, yeah, well. I guess you lost the art of Hollywood storytelling, but. No, we did not. In fact, we won a Webby Award, which is a digital marketing award for storytelling, which kind of surprised us. I think it really struck a chord with even people that weren't in agriculture. We tried to get that message right, that a farmer would identify themselves with it, as well as anybody that, you know, on the street could look at it and go, oh, I had no idea, you know. But yeah, I would say bold because we're taking on the infamous word climate change, perhaps.
Yeah, I thought it was gutsy and I liked it. And, you know, I there was a bit of skepticism among some of my colleagues, but only based on the desire. They want what you guys were saying to be true. But because of a long history, they don't feel like it necessarily is true. But I do believe, I don't know anyone that does not want what you were promoting to become the reality. Everybody wants it that I know.
You know what I think is that it was bold in that it was really leading because, you know, there's how many people that are raising food. I mean, if you decide what size the farms are, there might be many hundreds of thousands. Otherwise, there's millions of people in some ways. And there's got to be some that don't agree with the idea about climate change and the role that they should have. And that's where I feel like it's bold that you're providing leadership. Because you're getting out there, and I think you're projecting what a lot of people and most people might feel. But even more so than that, it ends up almost putting peer pressure on those that are having a hard time to get on and to join the mission. And by having that out there and having an organization like U.S. Farmers and Ranchers, you know, getting behind that and bidding that image, those that were having doubts and weren't maybe doing all that they could do, I think are going to get more motivated. You know, join the campaign, jump on board, get behind it.
Well, I appreciate you guys saying that. I will just say this, you know, I love how you said, Michael, everybody wants that vision to be true. And it's anyone who's in the food and ag sector that wants that vision to be true because we've inherently known we're doing great stuff. We feel like we're a sector that people just haven't maybe forgotten us. And that if you think about sustainability and climate change, I can't imagine another sector who's willing to take this on, who is the boots on the ground, all and block by block in every community, if you go all the way to the restaurant, that could be in a position to really take this topic on. It's just that we felt like we couldn't take it on, or that we weren't good enough, or that maybe it's just renewable energy that's getting all that attention. But really, we are the sector where green things happen. We are the brown and green, and the brown and green stuff is the cool stuff.
Yeah, it's true. And it will require change, though, right? I mean, I know that you there are a lot of growers and producers thinking about what are those changes involved with? What does it mean for our soil? What does it mean for our different processes? So that there's science that needs to be done. There's innovation that needs to be done. And there needs to be, I mean, the skepticism that exists is that you know, not all farmers act the same way. Not all farmers farm the same way. And the question is, can we get the vast majority of farmers capturing soil in the optimum way possible, capturing carbon in the optimum way possible? That's the challenge, right? And so it seems to me that the dialogues that you're doing now with industry, are they not about these things, how we're going to do it?
Yeah, so I think, like, one, every farmer is going to be so hyper unique. Like, every acre that they farm and every sub acre is going to be so unique. The question is, rather than talking about the practices or want you to be doing this all the same way, is really enabling the outcome base. Even a small change really adds up. You know, even if you look at right now, all these cars are off the road, right? Well, agriculture, we're sequestering, we're sinking it down even as we speak, right? And when a farmer is making these small changes, it adds up over time cumulatively. Yes. And that's why you'll always hear me say climate smart agriculture. It's really, you can have a variety of techniques. Or another way of saying it, we would never ask a chef to go cook a steak the exact same way, mm-hmm. right? And you think about it that way, like a farmer is a little bit like a chef. There's 1,000 different ways to get to that outcome. And that's specific to that kitchen. That's specific to the technique. You know, you can broil sous vide, you know, put it on a grill or pan fry. I mean, thousands of different ways. I use that as the most simple example because we tend to in farming get into these practice-based conversation as opposed to almost that recipe or the, do you have the art and technique and trust in that chef to get to the outcome? And we need to like start lifting up the conversation beyond practices to enabling those outcomes.
So I would agree with that totally because you're absolutely right. There are differences on the landscape, climate, all kinds of differences. And the outcome is what we care about. And one of the things that I've really admired about the wine industry and the almond industry and the rice growers in California is their annual reports where they're actually sharing the outcome differences. Is that something you see that could happen with industry nationwide where different sectors, whether it's dairy or beef or grains, they would actually be showing at the end of a year, how much more carbon they captured, how much more water they kept clean, da 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 da. Do you see that kind of thing possible?
Absolutely. So we've known how to measure carbon. A lot of us have done life cycle assessments. We're actually going back and figuring out how to integrate these life cycle assessments to see if we can get to that. We're also sponsoring the National Academy of Science report. In the Ecosystem Services paper we launched last year, it said that agriculture is on a trajectory to be minus 4% net negative. It sounds so weird, carbon. But we think that we can update that number in the future. And then USDA, as you know, they put forth their new Ag Innovation Challenge. As part of that Ag Innovation Challenge, there's a metrics and quantification in there. And they said that they would be quantifying those metrics. So a lot of these metrics rely on NAS data, and we often don't have the ability to back into the carbon or water numbers. I'm really excited that they've taken that on, because that'll allow it really advance the sciences. And then I think as we get smarter on integrating these metrics, we'll be able to start quantifying that. This is, we had a long ways to go. We really have a long ways to go.
Well, it's a big challenge, and that's understandable. Roger, I'm sorry.
No. You know what? I was just thinking that you have this voice, and you're creating this image, and people are following your lead and hearing you talk about what you're trying to do with sustainability and the good story that agriculture is doing. There are so many other organizations that are also kind of the voices of agriculture, the councils and the boards and the commissions and the Farm Bureau and Farmers Union. Are you seeing any influence from you on them? Are they jumping on and anybody extending this message?
Well, I think, you know, in agriculture, we're not short of acronyms. We've got tons of different groups, even in a state, every state. Our job is, we call it the hive. We want everyone working together on a more strategic plan and put their strengths to work. Each one of those organizations have different strengths. We want them included and working together. And we have over 54 different farm groups in our network, which includes Farm Bureau, many of those organizations that you were talking about. But they're all, you know, their own little world, right, of different ecosystems and different people in those groups. But, to, you know, coming back to what we were talking about, is having that collective vision is what's been so key. We've often been the only individual acronyms. We have never really truly worked together on a strategic plan. You know, if I could say, like, where's the strategic plan for food and ag right now?
Yeah.
Where would you go find it? You know, so where are we going in the next decade? You know, the fact that CEOs of all those organizations don't have a home to go work together, that's really what our mission is to really start this. Let's get going. Let's work together.
Well, I am conscious of time. We're approaching the end. So, Roger, I was thinking that we might just ask Erin what she sees for the happening for the next year until we have another conversation. What does she hope will happen? And then we can check in a year from now.
Perfect question.
Wow, guys. Well, I think the next 3 months matter, what we do and how we're emerging from COVID, these learnings, and that there's a will to really plan for that next decade. We're gearing up for September to really create a leadership moment of learning and really commitment to the next decade, so that I hope by this time next year we would be in a position to truly have signatories or leaders that believe in a strategic plan and roadmap for the next decade of ag. But each week has been something new here. It's been quite a challenge, but hopefully we can keep that candle holding bright.
So we not only have to check in with you in a year, we're going to have to do this again in 2030 to see how that decade went.
Absolutely. Yeah. I will look forward to that moment.
Well, it sounds like, what you're talking about as your goal for the year, I mean, that's like creating the UN. I mean, that's a big thing in the agricultural world. So I wish you tremendous luck. I'm pulling for you. I want it to happen. And appreciate your efforts and wish you all the best.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.